The devices that people are handing to you are not conference swag. You have to give them back, but they're clickers. We're going to do some surveying at the end of this session, so I think it'll be really fun. This session is on ethics, which has come up several times during the day, so I think this will be a really helpful session. Emma Maris is going to start out. Chris Woodside and Jane Braxton Little will talk about some of their experiences, and we have one program change, which is that Lee Wilkins could not make it, but instead we have Robert McClure, who is an SEJ board member, longtime member, distinguished reporting background in Seattle and Florida before that, and now directs Investigate West, which is a nonprofit news service. So this is going to be a great session, and let's go right in. Hello. Okay, so I'll explain the clickers really briefly. So what we're going to do in this session is each of us are going to chat just a little bit for about 5 to 7 minutes about some ethical issues that we've faced in our careers and either how we dealt with them or, in my case, I haven't really dealt with them, so I'll just be kind of throwing my hands up and asking you for help. And then we are going to go into the interactive portion of the session, where we're going to be posting some sort of hypothetical ethics challenging situations on this screen and giving you a list of potential resolutions. You know, should the person do this, do that, or do the other thing? And you get to vote with these clickers about what the person should do. And what we'll get is we'll get a real-time bar chart that will show how we voted. So we'll be able to sort of pull the collective wisdom of everybody here in the room instantly without everybody having to stand up and make long speeches. So it should be, I hope, illuminating for us to see what the other members of the freelancing community think about these issues. So I'll just go ahead and start. Basically, I originally proposed an ethics session for SEJ because I had my own ethical conundrum that I was having difficulty with. And I thought that if I proposed a session about it, I would be forced to research the topic in order to run the session, and that I would therefore carve some time out to actually address this instead of just worrying about it. So my story is that I'm a freelance writer who wrote a book that came out in 2011. It's called Rambunctious Garden. By the way, it just came out in paperback. Makes a lovely gift. And as has been mentioned before, book writing is a great way to work on your brand or to kind of elevate yourself into the status of being an expert, to have these great conversations, but it's not like a huge money maker, generally speaking, unless you really luck out. And I didn't really luck out, but I have had some amazing conversations that have come out of the book. Now, I wrote about my experience writing the book for the Science Writer's Handbook that was already been plugged a number of times. But at the time that I wrote that piece, what I wrote about was how shocked I was by the amount of promotion that one has to do. And this promotion was pretty much uncompensated. There's not really publicity budgets to speak of in most publishing houses these days. You have to do a lot of your own hustling. You have to make a lot of your own connections. And I was going around speaking about my book to various audiences, NGOs, conferences like, you know, within the fields. I wrote, the book was about conservation and ecology. So I talked at ESA and SCB conferences. And I talked to the Seattle Garden Club and the public library in the town I was living in, places like that. And generally speaking, I wasn't really getting paid for any of this. It was just to promote my book. But pretty soon, I found that doing all this promotional work, I was just totally going broke. And I have two little kids, and my husband was tired of watching our kids for 3 or 4 days, you know, while I went off to not make any money. So eventually, I sort of thought, okay, I can't keep this up. You know, I have to not promoting your book is sort of almost not an option, because if you don't get very good book sales, you might never be able to write another book again. You know, this is my fear. So what I'll do is I'll just cut back. And the way I'll cut back is I'll start asking for a lot more money. And then that way, most of my gigs will go away, and maybe I'll actually make some cash. So that's what I've been doing this year, is I've been asking for, like, big, fat speaking fees. And some people are willing to pay them, which is kind of shocking. So I've been doing that, and this is sort of suddenly created this situation where this unexpected new revenue stream of public speaking has showed up in my life. I found that I like it because I get to meet all sorts of diverse audiences and talk to people about these interesting ideas and have a slightly different relationship with people than I do as when it's a source reporter relationship. It's more like a people who are all interested in the same topic having a conversation, and I can indulge myself and talk a lot about what I think instead of normally as a reporter when you just start trying to bite your tongue and just elicit what they think. Okay, so long story short, though, is that I'm taking money from all sorts of people, right? I'm taking money from, in the last couple of years, I've taken money from the Nature Conservancy and the University of Oklahoma, Notre Dame University, the Seattle Garden Club. I've taken money from, I'm going to speak at a conference in a couple of weeks in Sacramento, which is a conference about forest management that's hosted by the University of California, Berkeley, but it has a number of sponsors, and the check that I got in the mail came from Sierra Pacific, the logging company, which was slightly startling. And, you know, I did another talk that to some sort of think tank, but then that check said Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors on it. So sometimes I don't even know who the checks are going to be signed by when I do these events. It can be complicated funding. And then the question is, can I ever write about any of these people who've cut me checks? My initial thought was that I should be able to because I'm doing one-off gigs. These are my clients for a one-off gig. I'm talking. I am not promoting their good or service to the outside world. I'm giving them the benefit of my years of reporting and sort of entertaining them. You know, I might as well be sort of doing the soft shoe up in the front, and then they write me a check, and that's the end of our relationship. And I certainly feel strongly that I'd be perfectly capable of writing about them in an objective way after I've cashed their check. But not maybe everybody agrees with me. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I am subconsciously being influenced by the $600 that the Nature Conservancy paid me. So that $600 is the one I rue the most because the Nature Conservancy is one of the biggest environmental NGOs on the planet, if not the biggest. Not long after I gave that talk, I collected my $600 and, paid my electricity bill and a couple weeks of daycare with it. I pitched a story involving the Nature Conservancy and disclosed in the pitch that I'd done this, and the pitch was rejected. The editor said it probably seemed like too much of a conflict. And I was like, crap, if I cannot write about the Nature Conservancy, what have I just done to my environmental journalism career? I was very depressed and despondent, and that's why I decided to have this ethics session. So we can figure out how I can continue to have my cake and eat it too. Or something, or I don't know. But I mean, it points to a larger problem, I think, for freelancers, which is that we've just heard all morning about how we need to diversify our revenue streams and we need to do lots of different kinds of work. And how we need to balance those works with the work that we're passionate about with work that pays the bills. And very frequently, the work that pays the bills is work that is the person, people, originally for this session, I wanted to have somebody who, like me, who takes speaking fees, somebody who writes for a lot of NGOs, foundations, alumni magazines, that kind of work, pretty lucrative work that a lot of freelancers use to kind of balance with their more passionate projects. And then I wanted to find the pure freelancer, the freelancer who only writes for 100% journalism outlets, never writes for any kind of foundations or NGOs or anything, and does it full-time, makes a living off of it, and is not married to an executive at Google. And I could not find that person. If they are here today, please come up and join us at our panel. Because I looked and looked, and I was not able to find somebody who made a full-time living and supported a family on pure journalism in an era where you get, 50 cents a word for a lot of print and a lot of online work is you expected to do for free. So I don't come to, I feel kind of bad. You guys paid some money to come here and get wisdom, and all I have for you is a big fat question mark. How can we, as freelancers, remain ethical operators and make money and be able to pay the bills? I don't know. Before we have some more perspectives on these challenges, I thought I'd talk a little bit about ethics policies, because when I was struggling with this and trying to figure out what I should do, I spent some time looking at different ethics policies. And the one that made me want to cry, of course, is the New York Times, because they have very rigorous policies This is some of their verbiage about outside contributors. And, you know, it's not worth reading it very, very carefully, but basically, they're supposed to have the exact same standards as the employees, including no conflicts of interest or appearance of a conflict, no free transportation, lodging, gifts, junkets, commissions or assignments from current or potential news sources. So that's, I mean, like, once you get to that potential, so commissions or assignments would probably cover speaking fees, I'm guessing. And assigning editors should be aware that a freelancer's previous involvement and professional behavior can prove an embarrassment. They should make every effort to ensure that a freelancer has no history or ties that would raise a real or apparent conflict of interest on a particular assignment. So I guess I'm not going to be writing for the New York Times anytime soon about any of my growing list of speaking clients. And if it becomes a professional goal of mine to write for the New York Times, I better quit speaking like tomorrow. However, I've been getting up to $5,000 to give a speech, and I cannot imagine getting that much money from the New York Times for anything. Except maybe, you know, I don't know, some kind of a real celebrity get or something. But so here's another sort of ethics policy source, which is the Society for Professional Journalists. And there's a lot more detail on their website for all these different bullet points, but these are their sort of basic core principles. Minimize harm. Seek truth and report it. I mean, we can all sign up to that one, obviously. Minimize harm. Act independently. And acting independently, there's a lot more detail there. But I think that what's interesting is that there's been a new initiative from the Poynter Institute to revisit some of these principles. And they just had a book come out. In fact, I have it over here. This summer, that talks about the changing face of these. And this is their new rules. Here's the book. It's worth a read, although disappointingly short on freelancer topics. They keep going on and on about how, like, everything has changed, journalism has changed, so your newsroom needs to change too, and whatever. But what they've done, interestingly, is they've replaced, you know, be independent with be transparent. And in my research on this, this seems to be an overriding theme, that the sense that we need to be totally independent has changed into a sense that we need to be very transparent with our readers. And I think I don't have enough time to get into that in a lot of detail, but I think it's a really interesting shift. I think part of it is probably driven by this market forces that I talk about, where you just can't make a living being totally independent. So if there's zero people who are acting ethically, either we all go to hell together or the ethics policies change. But I think another reason maybe why transparency has begun to replace independence is that we actually are having much more of a conversation with our readers and listeners and viewers than we used to have. It used to be sort of we stand on the mountain and we tell it how it is, and they are down there grateful for the knowledge that we've just dropped on them. And I think it's much more of a back and forth now, and so transparency is sort of in that spirit of being like, hey, guys, so here's how I found out about this stuff. Here's why you should believe me. Here's why you might want to take what I say with a grain of salt. You know, let's seek truth together collaboratively. So a lot of journalists, some freelance and some newsrooms, have started posting their own disclosure statements online, either through their employers or independently. Kara Swisher, she works for All Things D, which is like a Dow Jones related business site. And her Essex statement is worth reading. It's 1,500 words, and it's very detailed. She talks about her spouse, Megan Smith, and then she goes on about how she's willing to have conversations about the ethical problems that might produce, but she will delete any comments about, you know, the fact that she's married to a woman. So I like that. And then Mark Gunther, who is a freelancer, has a disclosure statement on his own website that runs to about 1,150 words that goes through his kind of philosophy about what he does, what he's taken as far as compensation, and how he handles it. And disclosure is his big watchword. And he links to Malcolm Gladwell. So seeing as this was an ethics session, I decided that it would probably not be cool to have use photographs without permission from the copyright holders. And seeing as Malcolm Gladwell didn't write me back, I just drew a picture of him. So he has an incredibly long ethics statement, which is 6,372 words, which is very detailed, partially because he's gotten a lot of criticism for taking very large speaking fees about his books while also being on the staff at The New Yorker. But it's worth a read. He makes some interesting points about how he has an obligation to his publisher to try to promote the book, and that he would be, you know, remiss if he just sat around and did nothing to promote it. They wouldn't be happy with him. And he also talks about the myth of the unbiased journalist and so on. So I'm thinking more and more that I think this is something that I would like to do, and then the question just becomes, how detailed do I get? How much do I disclose? Do I have to disclose who I voted for? Do I have to disclose who I root for in the Super Bowl? Do I have to disclose how much money various people have paid me? How many years back do I have to go? And if I write one of these, 6,000 ethics statements on 6,000 word ethics statements, will people think that I have something to hide because I'm just banging on about ethics so damn much? So these are my open questions. I may never be able to work for the New York Times, but I think that I can probably still work for a lot of outlets by being incredibly, almost monotonously transparent. And that's so far, that's my approach, but I'm still really working through this. So that's me. Now we will hear from Jane Braxton Little, who is a freelancer who from the Northern Sierra Mountains. Sierra means mountains, doesn't it? And she will tell us a little bit about writing for NGO-type magazines and how she negotiates that.
Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about freelance ethics by telling you how my career as a journalist evolved and how my ethics evolved along with it. Can you hear? Is this loud enough back there? Okay. My background, since ethics are all about what's personal, I'll give you a little bit of my backstory. I have an MA in Japanese cultural history, and I thought I was going to be an academic. But lo and behold, my husband and I moved to the Northern Sierra for a summer, and since I love my husband and he wanted to stay there, I'm still there. Many summers later, many winters too, it gets cold. So for the first couple of years, I taught Japanese cultural history. I taught things like the Man-Yoshu and Zen arts and so on. And after I saturated the market in a place where people really didn't know the difference between China and Japan, I realized, okay, something has to give. I have to move on here. So I had frequent fantasies about being a freelance writer, but I had no realistic prospects until the local newspaper, the local community weekly, needed somebody. I needed a job. I was hired. And my story is a lot like Jim's story. You know, when you work for the local newspaper, you write the news, you deliver the newspapers, you fix the toilet in the office, and you get to interview anybody. It's just it's a free-for-all. But in terms of ethics, it was a really good way to get started because newspaper ethics are pretty clear. It's he said, she said journalism. You balance everything out. And in a community where you do it all, everyone knows what you're doing, everyone sees what you're doing. And one thing, as I was thinking about putting this together, I remembered long, long ago, my sister-in-law gave me one of those grocery bags that I'm actually still using. It must be 20 years later. And it had a Sierra Club logo on it. Well, I'm not a member of the Sierra Club. I have never been a member of the Sierra Club. And in my little logging community, the Sierra Club is like death. I mean, people have bumper stickers that say, Earth first, we'll log the other planets later. That's kind of... Oh, sorry. I punched too many things. But I touched that. Sorry. So when I would use this bag, it was a really cool grocery bag, and I would just carry it around, and I keep the logo next to my thigh so nobody could see that I was carrying a Sierra Club bag. So, you know, that really is kind of an ethical statement. I was concerned about how it was perceived and also what I was doing. I didn't belong to the Sierra Club. I just liked the bag. So with community journalism, you're just really out there on your own. Everyone knows what you do and where you go and who you do it with. And really, looking back on that, I think it was a good way to get started in terms of the ethics. I began stringing for the Sacramento Bee pretty early on, and soon I became a correspondent, and I liked doing that. I liked working at the regional level instead of the community level, although I was still doing both. But I wanted to write long-form narratives, and I wanted to write with more of a science focus, so I began reaching farther on, and High Country News was one of the first places that I wrote for regularly on a national level. It's a Western regional newspaper, but it goes all over the country. And whereas a local newspaper sifts stories geographically, High Country News sifts its stories through a natural resource filter. But once you get into a story, it's balanced. You do all sides of the story. I wrote for American News Service, which some of you might remember was Francis Moore LePay's effort at spreading good news. And spread it we did for about 3 or 4 years, and then it went defunct. It was similar in that it sifted stories through a good news. I used to call it the Pollyanna press a little bit, but it was fun to write for, but it was, once again, once you got into a story, it was both sides. So I think newspapers, then I began pitching stories to magazine, and I began hitting, so I think newspapers gave me a pretty good ethical start. It was all about independence and transparency, all of the conflict of interest things. You buy your own lunch, all of that stuff, you know. But the news thing with early on were NGOs. American Forest was an early one. Audubon was an early one. Wilderness was one. And at first I didn't think too much about the conflict of interest with writing for an NGO. I just thought, like High Country News, they are using an environmental filter for choosing their stories, but once you get into the material, you treat it with an even hand. But obviously there are some potential conflicts of interest with NGOs. They all advocate for something. American Forest advocates for trees. Okay, that's pretty pure. Audubon advocates for birds. Wilderness advocates for wilderness. But advocacy obviously has some political ramifications, and these are not pure science or general interest publications. They all have a business side, and they all have a political side, and the political side of almost every NGO is going to be advocating for lobbying for certain kinds of legislation, lobbying against other kinds of legislation. So there's that to think about, there's that to deal with, but they're attractive publications for writers, at least for me. It is long-form narrative style. You get to write in your own voice. The topics are enormously interesting to me: science, natural resources, the environment. And there are assignments that are available. These magazines are not just hopelessly unattainable, like The New Yorker. I have a big file of New Yorker rejections. I'm proud of my rejections, but, you know, I'm not holding my breath to pay my rent with the next New Yorker story. It's not going to happen. So how do you balance these potential conflicts with making a living? For me, I've just tried to retain the code of personal and professional ethics that I developed way back with newspapers. I never accept an assignment that I view as promotional. If I get an assignment or somebody, I'm approached by an editor with something that sounds rah-rah, it probably is rah-rah, and it's probably not journalism. One time I was asked to write by one of these NGO publications, I was asked to write a piece about floodplain management, below the dam management, and it was really a, it was not by the magazine, it was not by the editor that I work with, but another arm of the NGO. And the piece was really designed as a how-to for agency people. It was going to go out to Army Corps and their state counterparts. And it really was the techniques and the philosophy that this NGO had developed. And I was really uncomfortable with it. It was really good money, but I rejected it because I thought, that really isn't journalism. That really is, I'm calling it rah-rah, there are other terms for it. But I turned it down. I probably early on accepted one or two assignments that I would now not accept. One of my very first assignments was to do a profile on an Olympic downhill skier who was raising bulls. And the assignment was for Beefmaster Quarterly, about how this kid was really good at raising bulls. Well, I wouldn't do that now. It just seems unethical to me now. So another thing that I try to do is work with publications that I know have a clear firewall between the organization and the magazine. And as the top management at these organizations changes, sometimes that firewall weakens. And I'm actually not writing for one or two old standbys because I'm just not comfortable with where that management is coming from and how the magazine is withstanding the pressure from the management side. I always try to work with editors that are committed to good science, and you'll quickly figure out who they are, and they are out there. I mean, most editors at most NGO publications are good editors who are committed to good science. So I suggest that you just stick with the ones that you trust, because they are going to go to bat for you. They are going to protect your integrity as a journalist. They are going to battle for journalism over any kind of advocacy that could creep into the story. And you, when you get an assignment, you can work with the editor, and you can talk about the things that you aren't really comfortable with, and shape the story around what the research reveals, not what the direction that, you know, the management might want to tweak you toward. I think you just have to resist those kinds of tweaks. And earlier today, Tasha said something that I thought was worth remembering, that under any circumstances, you control the story, and you shape it in the ways that your research directs you, and among those ways is what you're comfortable with ethically as a journalist. And in the end, if it's moving in a direction, or it takes a sudden wide in a direction that you're uncomfortable with, you can pretty much always get out of it. I don't think I've never had to do that. I hope you don't have to do it either. But my commitment is always just to the material, to the places and the species and the science that the research takes me to. It's great to work for publications like EHP and Scientific American and The Daily Climate and publications like that that do not have a political connection. But the reality is that I'm probably never going to be writing for them exclusively. I'm always going to have NGOs as part of the mix for me. So I like this concept that Emma brought up of transparency, and I'm going to develop my own personal ethics statement. I don't know how far it will go into what I eat and what I don't eat, what my other food fetishes might be. But that's one of the things that I've gotten out of preparing for this workshop, is that's going to be a task that I take on soon. And I do think that it's all about transparency. And if you get an assignment and you are transparent with the editor about where you can go and where you can't go, where you will go, where you won't go, that might end that assignment right there. But you're ending up with your ethics, and I think that's that's a really important concept, I think, for all of us. So I'm going to turn it over to Chris Woodside, who is going to tell you what she does, and then we're going to open it up for everybody. Here's your clicker.
Clicker, is this?
That's it.
This? Okay. Hi. I'm Chris Woodside. I'm based in Connecticut. I live in a town called Deep River, population 4,500. About equidistant between Boston and New York. I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in Philadelphia. I have been a freelancer as of the 13th of October for 13 years. And when I said to my husband that it was time for me to be a full-time freelancer, his remark was, "I guess I can't stop you." I love my husband. I'm here today on the ethics panel because in addition to the freelance writing that I do, I am editor of two journals that are published by nonprofits. Okay, there's my little opening slide. And I'm going to discuss how I keep them honest and me honest. The first of these journals is called Appalachia, and I know we're in the South now. We don't call it Appalachia. We call it Appalachia. It's published by the Appalachian Mountain Club, and it's a 160-page journal of essays and journalism on mountains and conservation and research. It comes out in June and December, and the mission of the Appalachian Mountain Club, this is not their member magazine, by the way, this circulates to the general public. The Appalachian Mountain Club has a mission to, quote, promote the protection, enjoyment, and understanding of the mountains, forests, waters, and trails of the Appalachian region. The other magazine that I edit is a quarterly. It's published in Connecticut by the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. That's another 501c3. Both of these organizations are 501c3 nonprofits. CFPA is an organization that was founded in 1895 by people who looked around and discovered that there were no trees left in Connecticut and there were about two deer left. And their original goal was to promote forestry. They then would do things like quietly sit at meetings during the 1930s and write checks to buy state parks and things like that. CFPA ultimately became a trail maintaining organization, and today they organize a whole group of volunteers who maintain 800 miles worth of trails that are known as the Blue Blazed Hiking Trails. I'll probably be talking a little bit more about my relationship with CFPA because it's a little more interesting and tricky. CFPA has a mission to protect forest parks, walking trails, and open spaces for future generations by connecting people to the land. One of the former executive directors of CFPA once said to me that when you looked at their I think it's called the 990, you know, you can look up what nonprofits do, and I recommend that if you ever write for a nonprofit or are trying to negotiate a contract with a nonprofit, that you look at their 990. If you find out that they're paying their executive director $400,000, then you can ask for a little more money than you thought. It made a huge difference for me. One of the former directors once said to me, you know, if you look at our 990, most of what we're doing is publishing. It's actually the majority of what we do. And I love that because that continues to guide me. Both of these organizations do a limited amount of lobbying. They are legally allowed to do that, but they are not allowed to do more than a certain percentage. And if someone here knows what that percentage is for 501c3, 5? Yeah, it's 5%. Yeah. So that gives me a lot of leverage, too, where I really distance myself. I find myself walking through the offices of both these places at times, particularly at Connecticut Forest and Park, where the director will say, come in, our lobbyist is here. We'd like you to come and have a chat with a strategy to cover blah, blah. And I'm kind of like, well, I'll come in and listen to what you have to say and do an article about everything. I also spent years convincing them to do an article about this tremendous controversy going on in Connecticut about all-terrain vehicles, which are illegal. It's kind of like drugs in some places. You know, you can buy an all-terrain vehicle legally in Connecticut, but there's nowhere you can ride it legally. So you could buy it and put it in your front yard and stare at it. And there are organizations of you know, nice guys with kids who are scout leaders, who are all-terrain vehicle leaders, and they, you know, I finally talked them into letting me do this article. I go and interview the head of the all-terrain vehicle group, and he says, "Oh yeah, I take my son out all the time. I'm teaching him how to do this. I show him where the places are, you know, where it's not legal to ride and that kind of thing." And so, what's happened over time with these two publications is, I'm able to convince them that they need to do good journalism. You know, the ATV thing was a wonderful example. Obviously, the people in CFPA all hate all-terrain vehicles, and they want me to hate them too. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of them myself. I've always said if I got on one, I would probably like it too much and then go buy one. But, you know, it's just really important that we remember that there are a lot of people in the state of Connecticut. It's a very populated state. There's a bunch of people who love these things, and I am not an advocacy journalist. I just wanted to point out that the cover of this Connecticut Woodlands is about an article I did after our Miami conference, when I co-led a tour down to the Everglades, and I discovered that the man who's called the father of the Everglades was a landscape architect from New Haven, Connecticut. And nobody in Connecticut remembered him at all, so I did a big issue all about him. And he, you know, in Connecticut, he used to say to people, use all sorts of exotic plants and just plant them in your yard. And then he got down to Florida and he's, you know, preserve our wonderful, you know. So it was an interesting thing. So let me talk a little bit about my contracts with these two magazines. This is a piece out of my Appalachian Mountain Club contract. I didn't make this up. You know, some of this is sort of boilerplate, but this, again, is a beacon to keep me honest and to keep them honest. I am an independent contractor. I am not representing the Appalachian Mountain Club. I am not their spokesperson. I am not their advocate. Now, that said, I do buy a membership in the AMC every year. I go hiking. My contract gives me some free stays in their little cabins up on the ridge, because I need to do that for my work. And for Connecticut Forest and Park, there's even some other things that I do. My contract with them says, again, the contractor is not an agent or employee of CFPA. No joint venture or principal-agent relationship exists. And that means that when the development director of CFPA comes up to me and he says, you know, Chris, we need to do more articles about important fundraising and the importance of everybody being really commit. And, you know, I smile at him, and I want them to raise money for their organization. But I will say, Connecticut Woodlands is not a member service magazine in that way. And he'll look at me like, blink, 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 there you go again, Chris, you know. I'm just constantly guiding them back. They have a member newsletter. They have a member website. They have letters they send out to people. They have events. And the more that I can remind them that Woodlands is their journalism outlet, and then these other things are their rah-rah, we're so great outlet. So we have to have a distinction. I believe it is my role to teach them that. They don't know it if I don't teach it to them. And I think that we have a role as journalists working for nonprofits. I spent the first 18 years of my career working for newspapers, and I often will say to myself, my livelihood was funded mostly by auto dealerships in the towns where my newspapers were. I mean, that's the truth. They were the big, big advertisers in these papers. Now, of course, we never paid any attention to the ads. The ad department was in another, you know, on another floor or whatever. But the money does come from somewhere always. And I think the key with us, with our integrity, is that we separate ourselves from doing the job of bringing the money in. We are here to do good journalism. These are a couple of examples I have for how I rein them in. But before, let me just make sure that I didn't miss something. I think the phrase that I use with our development director, the development director at Connecticut Forest and Park, was, we're not a development tool. And, you know, he was a little miffed at me, but I had to say it. I have been editing Woodland since 2001. I did it originally as a temporary thing, and then I negotiated a contract with them that we renew every year or two, depending. Usually it's a two-year contract. About 5 years ago, I convinced them to create a little separate member newsletter that I have nothing to do with at all. Initially, they would turn in things to me about, you know, when we're having our meeting and who won the awards, and I would edit those things. Now, a couple other ethical comments. I do not write about anything these organizations are doing for anybody else. So that is a limitation that I must accept. My freelance work outside of these editing jobs, I write about climate change, I write about climate research, I write about I'm writing a book about Laura Ingalls Wilder, the prairie author. I write about things that are outside the scope of these organizations. I just don't see how I could possibly, you know, do both those. It would be unethical, right? So I'm constantly having them say, "We have an ad. Would you please proofread this ad?" And then I told you the story about the all-terrain vehicle riders where I had to say I was going to be talking to them too. And they're like, "Oh, my God, what will our board say?" And I said, "I think they'll say it's a balanced article." They want the fundraising articles, you know, and I will occasionally... that last thing. I will occasionally get myself... I'll feel like I'm almost backed into a corner with them. And let me... talk a little bit about my personal volunteer work that I do. My husband and I decided that we would become volunteer trail maintainers in Connecticut. We've done a lot of hiking in our life. We did a lot of complaining about trail maintenance in our lives, and we felt it was time to do that. So I'm actually a volunteer for this organization that I do the magazine for. More delicate stuff going on all the time. I'm transparent about it. I talk about it all the time. I don't write articles about trail maintenance on the blue trails for, you know, somebody else without being clear. Trails and hiking are pretty benign topics, really. I mean, so in certain ways, I have it easier than somebody else might. But it's kind of like marriage, I guess. You know, every anniversary, my husband says, "Well, it's not too late to screw it up, is it?" You know. And, you know, what he means is that as long as you've got something good going, you know, don't get complacent and think that you can just start to do and say anything that you want. I think, was that the last thing? Yeah, that was sort of it. I guess, you know, I will be happy to answer any further questions that we have about this. And I will also, you know... I did a lot of writing for the New York Times, and that's kind of ingrained in me that, you know, no travel junkets, don't take presents from people and this and that. But, you know, occasionally you're at an event and somebody hands you a donut, you know, yes, you're going to eat I eat the donut, sorry. You know, so it's just a constant sort of balancing act. I don't join advocacy groups. I don't do... I don't go to sit-ins. I don't belong to Greenpeace. You know, there are just certain things that I do not do, and I think that's healthy for us. So thanks, and we can talk further after. Yeah. Oh, and here's Robert. Bob McClure. Robert.
Yeah, we'll just pull that up.
Yeah,
sure.
Hi, I'm Robert McClure. I'm the executive director of Investigate West, which is a nonprofit journalism studio based in Seattle, covering the Northwest and focusing on environment, public health, and government accountability. I'm not a freelance writer, although my wife, Sally Deneen, who's here and is a longtime freelance writer, refers to Investigate West as freelancers on steroids. So I think the reason that Emma asked me to stand in for Lee is that we have a kind of an unusual funding model from most journalists' point of view, I think, and that's because we are a nonprofit. Nonprofit journalism goes back a long way. The very first nonprofit journalism organization in this country was the Associated Press, and is the Associated Press, founded in 1846. They're kind of an unusual case, though. More typical would be somebody like Mother Jones or the Center for Public Integrity. So briefly, my story is that I was in newspapers and wire services for 30 years, and the newspaper where I was working in Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, decided it was going to go online only and showed 90% of us to the door. And so a bunch of us, seeing the need for continued depth on environment and public health and government accountability, got together and formed this nonprofit news group. It's evolved into what I call a journalism studio. I won't take a lot of time to tell you more about that, but we take story ideas, we choose them very carefully. We invest in original reporting and story development, and then we take those to news partners, in which we work with and collaborate with in a variety of ways. I'm here because we're funded primarily by foundations, and I know that some freelance writers are interested in possibly getting foundation funding, and some already have. So I was going to talk briefly about the ethical issues involved. So to tell you how desperate we were, I mean, we were actually on unemployment for the first 14 months after having founded this thing. So we really needed the money. We got our very first grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism, but it was a very small grant, and it was just to cover expenses for some trips we were doing. Our very first big grant came from the Bullitt Foundation. And I would go pull it up, but time is short. The Bullitt Foundation, the Bullitt family, is a Seattle family, originally made its money in timber, but really made its money when they bought King 5. They actually founded King 5, which was and probably remains the leading commercial TV station in Seattle. They sold that in either the 70s or the 80s for a boatload of money and founded this foundation, the purpose of which is largely to encourage originally environmental protection and now specifically urban sustainability. And they're a very interesting organization. They're run by Dennis Hayes. He was the organizer of the first Earth Day, ran the solar energy program under Jimmy Carter. Very much so. We're talking about advocates here, okay? These people are advocates. And our very first grant came from them about 8 or 9 months into our existence, and it was a $40,000 grant. It was the very first time we learned to fill out a letter of inquiry and grant application. We sent it in. I've known Dennis Hayes for many, many years and used to talk to him on a regular basis when I was covering environment for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. So we took this $40,000 grant, and we still weren't able to pay ourselves because we had too many people working there at the time. And anyway, we went on. That, though, actually was, I think, a lot of the reason that we landed a $100,000 grant in February of the next year from the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, which is it's the fortune from the Daily Oklahoman. They're very much into investigative reporting. And at the time that this happened in 2009, there were a number of different small shops setting up around the country to do this sort of investigative reporting in various ways. We're the only one that's really sort of evolved into this studio model. In any case, here's the basic thing, is that the next pile of money that came in is we went out and got $10,000 from the Russell Family Foundation, which is completely dedicated to doing the restoration of Puget Sound, which is something that I'd written a lot about for the PI. The $10,000 wasn't a grant. That was a $10,000. It was a white paper research we did. They wanted us to go out and do sort of the lay of the land, both physically and politically, in these four watersheds that they were thinking about focusing on. So we did that. But then we did also get a grant from them a couple months later for, I believe, it was $25,000. And my contact there was this fellow who had been the King 5's environmental reporter before going to run basically a flax shop for green groups. Scott Miller is his name. And then he had gotten this job at Russell. So suffice it to say, we've gotten some grants and still seek grants from regional environmentally oriented foundations. And our basic, if you've heard it here a couple times today, our basic mantra is we're going to be transparent about where we're getting our money. And now I'll tell you, we also right now have a $100,000 ask out to this very business-oriented Foundation to hire a government accountability reporter. It's an invited ask. We have hopes that we're going to get that. So we're trying to balance out where we get our sources of funding, but we don't, we're not strictly balanced. One thing I can say is that because I was for many years doing lots of work at these regional newspapers, that I challenge people to look at the work I did there and look at the work that we're doing now and find any substantive difference in it. It's a dilemma. And so what we did is we asked our board to wrestle with this dilemma, and we came up with this financial policy. And I'm probably not going to want to read the whole thing, but basically what it says is that we are independent, and that the funders, that they can have no expectation that they can control any of our editorial activities. Again, I want to go fast because I know that time is short. So you can read, you can kind of scan there, but whoa. Oh, Mac. Oh, the Mac thing. Sorry. There we go. Okay. So there are actually kind of three categories that we have. So here's the first one: is we take money from organizations that support journalism. That's like the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, EEJF. I see my time is up. I'm going to go 2 more minutes. I'm sorry. Just so you can get these 3 points here. So in that case, no problem. I just go do the application, and if they give us the money, great, and everything's wonderful. the second one is how do you get this thing to go down? Sorry. So broad topical coverage. So for instance, our grants from the Bullitt Foundation are for covering urban sustainability. The latest thing we did was we plotted the locations of schools and highways and show where there were schools right next to highways where there was clearly going to be a health impact on the kids. But they didn't know. They gave us a grant for urban sustainability, and we go off and decide what we're going to do. The most problematic one is this last one, specific reporting projects. And so this is one where the board, if we're going to apply for something like this, where we're getting money to do a specific story or project, they want to know about it. So the best example of that lately has been we got a grant from the Satterberg Foundation for $10,000 to do, I should say our budget's $308,000, so just so you know, the relative size of these grants. we got a grant from the Satterberg Foundation. They're interested in young adults who are aging out of foster care, who've been in the foster system, and they get to be 18, and they kind of get bounced out on the street. And there's actually a really good story there about this cohort of kids that's just really, for the most part, ending up dead end, and it's a real problem. So, but it was specifically about that, and we said we're going to do 3 stories on this topic. And so it was $10,000 the first year, and we'll get another $5,000 in November. But that's the kind of thing I have to bounce off my board. I will tell you that the foundations that I've gone to, Dennis Hayes, you know, he and the Bullitts, they clearly understand like what independent journalism is about. When Scott was at Russell, you know, he came out of journalism. He knew. I guess what I'm telling you is we've been selective about who we go to, and we have talked to some foundations that were kind of interested, but we could see that they really wanted like to order. Basically, they wanted advocacy journalism. And by the way, as an SEJ board member, I need to say there's nothing wrong with advocacy journalism. This is a Big Ten organization, and we do have advocacy journalists in this organization. We are not. IWest is not one of those. The last thing that we felt was important was to tell these folks who are kindly giving us this money what they are entitled to. And you can read right up there what it is. We acknowledge their support. We give them public recognition. We say how the support will be used. This is just a legal thing. We have to tell them, you know, no goods or services were provided. It's a tax thing. We tell them what we're going to be doing, 3 stories over the course of the next year. Then the last ones are kind of throat clearing, actually. So I'm going to stop right there. You can read them for yourself. And glad to take questions or talk about this later.
Thanks so much. I can sense that this probably would be a good time to do questions, but I am so psyched about the clicker thing. Can we just... So let's try that. And then the hypotheticals that I put together for the clicker really touch on a lot of points that we discussed in these four presentations. So when we go through those, that could be a great time to ask questions of any or all panelists on those topics. So let's play with our toys. So hit the power button at the bottom, and you should get a little green light on. You want to grab a couple for the panel? Blue light. Okay, blue light. All right. Now, let's do a test run. Okay, so not everyone eats chicken. I was going to do a light meat, dark meat question, but there's probably lots of vegetarians. So there's the extra clickers over here. Robert will grab them for you. Okay.
Here, Jane and I can share.
No, you can't share a clicker. There's a bunch.
It's unethical.
If you don't have a clicker, just go to that box and grab one, yeah. Okay, so we're going to do a test run. So we'll do a morning person, night person. So if you're a morning person, hit A, and if you're a night person, hit B. Okay, ready, vote. Morning person A, night person B.
Oh, no.
Wow, look at that. Oh, you see, the night people take a little longer to reply. Okay, so that's how the game is played. And then what we're going to do is we're going to put up the scenarios, and then we'll have about a minute to read them, digest them, and then a minute is not a lot of time to go online and research ethics policies, so you'll have to consult your gut. Is this off so I'm not double-miked? Okay. All right. I'm going to leave it there, 50-50. Okay. So here is our first question. This is the one. So go ahead and read it. Basic scenario is she wants to write a feature for Audubon. She writes a feature for Audubon, and then 3 years later she finds out about a scandal having to do with Audubon. She would like to pitch this to a newspaper. Her source for the scandal is not anyone she knew from writing the piece for Audubon. It's a totally unrelated friend from her soccer team. So should she go ahead and not worry about the 2010 piece because there's no ongoing relationship, just pitch it? B, pitch it without mentioning the 2010 piece. Okay, you can go ahead and vote any time now. Then mention. This is what advice I've heard from many people, which is that you mention the potential conflict of interest after the pitch has been accepted. C, mention the piece and give reasons why it's not a conflict of interest in the pitch. D, pass the tip on to a freelancer friend who never worked for Audubon. Or E, do nothing. So we'll go for about 30 more seconds. Yeah, vote anytime. Oh no, I'll find it. It'll come back, don't worry. There's a little light that should light up once it took, so you should just be able to hit it once. Yeah. All right, let's see how we're doing. Ooh. Okay, looks like we have something approaching consensus. I'll stop it there. That the right thing to do would be to mention the piece and give reasons why it's not a conflict of interest in the pitch. But that there are some people in the room who feel like it's just a little bit too close to home and that you should pass the tip on to a freelancer friend. And then one real purist out there who says you should do nothing, although maybe they're just lazy. I gotta say, so here's what we'll do is we'll have the panel, anyone on the panel who wants to comment on this scenario? Do you think that this consensus represents the right answer, if there is any such thing? A and B? No, don't worry about the 2010. Pitch it and don't even disclose. That would be A. That was poorly written, my fault.
I have a comment.
I think it depends on if she thinks she's going to write for Audubon again in the future. I think that would probably... Well, let's say she only wrote once for Audubon 3 years ago and she's never going to do it again, and then she mention the piece and give reasons why. I guess I could see that. I actually voted for D myself. But if she's going to write for Audubon again, what would she say to... Then she'd have to tell them the next time she went to... And that's going to create a real awkward...
Well, I think C goes to the issue of transparency, which we've been talking about and which the Poynter Institute is touting, and which I think as long as you want to keep freelancing, and if Audubon has been one of your clients, you probably want it to be one of your clients again. Maybe your editor, and you are transparent, your editor may say, okay, that's it for you, but at least you come out of that with your ethics.
Looks like there's a comment there. Does somebody want to run? Is the other mic around?
Oh, right here.
Okay. Yeah, okay, that's a good question. Do we have any editors here?
Don't forget to identify yourself.
Oh.
We have an editor from Audubon.
Who's the editor from Audubon? Oh, tell us. Okay, so... You got pitch C, where they said, you pretend you're at the newspaper, and you get the pitch saying, okay, there's this huge scandal at Audubon. By the way, I wrote for them 3 years ago. Okay, let's say it's the other way around. They come to you with a huge scandal in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that's related to birds.
And I've written for them before. I think for Audubon Magazine, I'd probably say, okay, you have an interesting perspective. You're probably not going to get to write for them again. Let's talk about the story and see if it makes sense. But, you know, we would definitely have a lengthy discussion about what makes sense for us and whether we should continue the conversation.
In some ways, I feel like this is kind of analogous to my situation. Because by giving a talk to a group, I do something that's really close to writing a story for them. I provide a discrete service and get a discrete paycheck. So if I talk to the Nature Conservancy and then 3 years later want to write about something good or bad that the Nature going on in the Nature Conservancy, I'm in a situation that's pretty similar. All right, let's move on to the next one. I like this. All right. So this is a... When we did the survey, a lot of people were interested in the social media piece, which we haven't really talked about. So let's talk about it through this. You can vote anytime. So Yasha writes about oceanography. That's his beat. Yasha's the name of my husband. That's why I put that in there. He's also a staunch liberal. So presidential debate's on. He thinks of something really funny to say that is mean to the conservative candidate. So should he post it because politics isn't his beat and the unbiased journalist is a myth? Should he not post it because expressing it might cost him work, but hey, he has a right to his opinion? Or maybe not post it because he doesn't have a right to his opinion. I didn't give you that option. Or C, create a separate account that he can use for his personal opinions. We'll let it go for another few seconds. Okay, 3, 2, 1. Not post it is the winner. And yet, so many journalists, when I was watching the presidential debates this year, there were so many journalists saying very opinionated things on there. Did you guys notice that? And I have totally said opinionated things on Twitter. But there should probably be another rule about not tweeting after you've had a beer.
Just, I think that the B, there should have been a D, which would be not post it, not because it might cost you work, just because you're a journalist and you don't do that. That said, I'm kind of a hypocrite because one of my grocery bags does say, I support green power.
There's a comment.
Does it make sense?
I don't know. I mean, at some level, some part of me really thinks that so many journalists I know, if you go out and have dinner with them, they'll tell you exactly what they think about these politics. And the fact that they don't do that in public, how is that really serving their readers? They're just pretending that they don't have opinions, while that they really do. It seems to me that that doesn't speak to this transparency value that's becoming more important. Maybe we should all be posting who we voted for and tweeting about it. There was a... Oh, yeah.
My name is James Sims. I had a question. In my previous position, I used to write columns. And so I had really, really, sometimes really harsh opinions. And so if you're doing like an opinion piece, you know, versus sort of a regular journalistic piece, your views are going to be coming out anyway. And so if you've done those columns in the past, there's a record of what your views are, and then if you go back to, say, writing sort of straight sort of journalistic pieces, what happens then?
Yeah, good question. And I sort of feel like in some ways that's better, because now I know where you're coming from and I can look you up and say, find out why you wrote such a glowing, unbiased piece about the wind power project or whatever.
Dan Grossman, I wonder if you want to consider tweaking this a little bit, and saying rather than a tweet, be something that you say in public, like at one of your talks, which would make it bring it back to the reason why you wanted to have the, or why you were interested in this session. Because I voted for B, but I don't tweet. So I don't do much on Twitter. I feel like that's the right answer, and yet I do say things in the question and answer periods when I speak on climate change. I don't hold myself back, and someone could be tweeting that,
right?
Or even if they're not, it's a public forum. And I wonder what people feel about that. Are you supposed to talk about climate change without revealing anything related to your thought? Someone's going to say, what do you believe we need to do? What are you going to say?
So this next question, which looks very similar, but it isn't if you see, it goes directly to that point. In this question, he's not talking. He's not going to tweet about the presidential debate. He's tweeting about some congressional hearing on NOAA funding, which is right in the middle of his beat. So here, he has actually like an incredibly informed opinion, but it's also biting and funny, because he is an expert in this field, because this is his beat. So should he tweet his opinion? Should he keep it quiet because he's a journalist? Or should he do this whole separate accounts thing? So go ahead and vote on this one if you guys want. Nope. In this case, the tweet would be right central to his beat. I'm curious to know whether this changes this for people. We'll just do 10 more seconds. Okay. So, I don't know why these numbers are here, but... So, in this case, there's slightly more people think that he should actually post it than because it is part of his beat. No? Yeah, so not... Okay. All right, next question. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Just one interesting twist. What if he was to create his Yasha Pinko identity, but not post either thing? I mean, is there a problem having, you know, a self-deprecating identity that does indicate your leanings, even if you're not saying something negative about one of the candidates?
I don't know. All right, here's my issue. You guys ready to judge me? All right, so someone's written a book. She'd like to promote the book. But she'd also like to keep open the option about writing about the entities to whom she promotes the book. Should she, you know, these refuse any money from any of the people for whom she, or entities that want to have her as a speaker, and fund all the travel and time away from paying work through Kickstarter and a loan from her parents? Should she B, accept travel reimbursements but no speaking fees, on the kind of theory that one's income while the other one just makes you even? And then only accept as many invitations as she can afford, which might not be very many if she's like most freelancers. C, accept travel reimbursements from everybody and speaking fees only from academic institutions. This is actually the Andy Rodkin solution I asked him about. I'm actually not sure if he, yeah, that he'll take speaking fees from academic institutions, but not from, you know, like Chrysler or something. D, accept travel reimbursements and seek high speaking fees as a new revenue stream and then just disclose this when pitching. Or E, accept money from everyone and don't disclose since the talks are one-off gigs and not continuing relationships. Vote now. I can't promise I'll do what you say, but I'd like to know what we think. What's that? Yes. I need a lifeline. All right, a couple more seconds. 3, 2, 1. I don't think so. Okay. All right. I like these answers. So this is. I mean, what I'm seeing from these answers is a definite vibe of this new value of transparency over this value of independence. I mean, C, which also got quite a lot of votes, seems to be kind of a more of an independence-oriented response. What did you vote?
I said D because I don't really think that academic institutions should be considered somehow paragons of virtue in this. They all, you know, Texas Tech is very different from UC Berkeley. It's very different places.
Yeah, I gotta say, I kind of agree with that. The idea that universities don't have agendas.
Just to follow on that, since I live near Harvard, my husband works at Harvard, Harvard becomes a story in almost everything it does. So the idea that an academic institution is not a subject.
Any more comments on this one? Susan's coming with the mic.
Hi, I'm Louise Leaf. I just wanted to, and I don't have an answer to this, but I'm curious at people's views. One, the idea, there are several different categories. One is doing journalism, and then one is writing commentary, and then there's a whole category of blogging where people, that tends to be more filled with opinion and what the relationship is. And is it good to have people know where you come from, and does that affect your journalism? And, you know, should you not do one, or is it good to do all of them and just see where you're coming from? And the other one, I was, I know a lot of people here work for university publications, alumni publications, and as you said, everyone, universities have an agenda, news organizations have agendas too. Where do university publications and working for universities fit in this whole ethical sphere? As I said, I don't have any answers, but I'm curious to see where people are coming from in dealing with those issues. And is there a line, let's say, with a university publication that you shouldn't cross, or, you know, or not?
Does anyone here work for do a lot of work for university publications? Oh yeah, right, because you do your thing. So how do you barricade that off somehow?
I don't think so. I think there might be some conflicts. I mostly write about the car industry. And if auto companies sponsored the reports that I write, that would be an issue. That hasn't come up. But the sponsors have had nothing to do with what I write about. So it hasn't really been an issue yet.
That seems to be, from what I hear, a pretty common solution. I know a lot of people who, say, write about biomedical for university publications and then write about the environment for their journalistic clients. So what they do is they kind of create separate, you know, they divide it up by a beat so that they won't even be tempted to kind of have things slop over from one bucket to another and back and forth.
You know, a further ethical dilemma about it is I'm also in a position to seek funders for the reports that I write. And I could easily get auto companies to write to do that, and I would get like $5,000 a piece. But I just can't do that. I can't get money from them and then write about them. It's just not going to work. So it cuts off that particular, could be potentially very big, lucrative revenue stream.
There's a comment over there. I'll get the next question up while we're waiting here.
I'm having a real problem here. If you're an entrepreneur and you're a self-employed freelance journalist, you're a capitalist. And I think it's up to the individual to draw a line based upon their sense of right and wrong. And for some other entity to say these are the rules that everyone must play by, I don't know. I'm struggling with this because as an individual, I know what's right and wrong, and I go by my inner gyroscope. And
I think that's a really good point. And I mean, when you were showing your, when we looked at the contract language Chris has, and that similar languages in some of my contracts, and we were looking at your policies and talking about disclosure, I feel like everyone does ultimately have to follow the dictates of their own conscience. But for me, I think it would be helpful if I actually wrote mine down. So that I could explain them to others and so that it could be helpful for me to refer to when I'm trying to decide about something. I don't know. There's a comment on that.
I wonder. I just wanted to make a quick comment regarding this transparency statement or whatever we call it. I had to do something like that for an individual project because I got a question from one of the entities which might broadcast my product. And I said, I hadn't thought about that. Of course, I had done, the ethical thing and separated my funding source, and they had no control over the product and so on, from the subjects that I interviewed, the topics that I covered. But it hadn't occurred to me to do that. And I wonder if you could do it instead of generally, create for each product you create a mini transparency statement that is very specific to that product.
Sounds like a lot of work, but here's another one that as some of you may have seen an email that went out for the SEJ registrants offering to take people who came to the meeting on flights over the area to check out the biodiversity in the wilderness areas. And I'd actually had a conversation with a journalist friend of mine who had taken a flight for a piece by some sort of nonprofit organization that's whole job is to, give flights to journalists. And the reason that I'm really hung up on this is because when I was a very young journalist many, many years ago, covering Hurricane Katrina, it wasn't that many years ago, I went down there and I was running around with these university researchers and we flew all the way down from New Orleans to the Gulf, and it was fantastic, amazing visuals, really helped the story, and I never asked who paid for the flight. I just kind of waltzed onto the plane and waltzed off, and nobody at my newsroom, I was working for Nature at the time, nobody asked me either. And so now I'm kind of like, what was I thinking, So this is, but I'm interested in how, we can get resources for our reporting as freelancers without journalists, without newsroom budgets. Of course, they don't really exist anymore either, but for things like flights. I don't know if you can change your vote. Try clicking the other way. Maybe it'll, all right. Oh, yeah, the flight. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Take the flight. Sorry, that was poorly written because originally, not cash, just the flight. And in the other choices would be the cash for the flight. The amount, the exact amount you would need for the flight. Okay. All right. All right, we'll stop it now and see what we think. Whoa! Everyone's totally down with taking the flight from South Wings. But they're dedicated to the protection and restoration of ecosystems, so they have an agenda. So isn't that bad?
Voting amen that he should take the flight.
Yeah.
Right.
You guys have no problem with that?
I've taken these flights a number of times. No, I mean, I disagree that going up in the air and getting, it's they're donating their time and their cash for their gas, but they're up there to show you what's down on the ground and they can't change what you're seeing. So I don't see that as an issue. I've done it a number of times. I find it very helpful.
They can choose where they fly.
Yeah, for some reason, the exchange of cash makes a big difference to me. So just like you'd spend time with a researcher in his lab, they're offering up their time, and like you said, that's the same thing with this flight. So I think A's okay.
Wow, it's really interesting that whether it's money or in kind, because, I mean, the IRS doesn't care whether it's money or in kind as long as it's value.
I say put it in your story. I'm Erica Bolstead. I say put it in your story. Disclose where the flight came from, who you got the, why they are taking you up there, what their vested interest is. And if you think that taking their flight is going to change your view of this, it is going to lead you to write more favorably about them, maybe you shouldn't take the flight. But if you think it's just going to help inform your story, then take the flight and disclose it.
And I think transparency works both ways. You have to be transparent with that source, too, saying, thanks, but this doesn't mean you're influencing my coverage.
There's a couple more over here on this.
I'd just like to add an experience we had at SEJ on that very kind of subject. We ran a cover story on Katrina couple of years ago. We ended up using a donated photo from the New Orleans paper that the journalists let us use. But we had been looking at some really good photographs taken by Daniel Beltra, who's a freelancer from Seattle. Unfortunately, he did them on assignment for Greenpeace. And so we decided, because he had done them for Greenpeace. Now, my question was, it didn't change the picture any. I mean, the Coast Guard had taken many of the same pictures, and you really couldn't tell the difference between them. But the issue was, if we put a credit in there for Greenpeace,
right,
it's going to make us look bad. Interesting thing happened. Both Time Magazine and New Yorker ran pictures by Daniel Beltra, and significantly missing in the credit was that they were funded by Greenpeace. It just said photo by Daniel Beltra. And that became an issue at a NAPA meeting, actually, a year later, about, why did those agencies drop who paid to have the picture taken?
So the moral of the story is that SEJ is more ethical than the New Yorker.
And Time.
I just want to add one thing. I noticed increasingly the New York Times, in some environment stories by like Felicity Barringer and others, will have a video or a photograph of like the Southern Utah blah 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 alliance. And I've just been noticing that more. I'm not quite sure what to say about it. I mean, they do credit it, but it's certainly the NGO.
Actually got another point, but I'll follow on Roger's point that there were a lot of scandals with BP providing flights over the spill and using that to manipulate journalists, which kind of sets a yin and yang going there, where who do you trust?
I was going to ask whether you'd take their flight too.
I'm with a small organization now, but I did that when we were with large newspapers that were thinking hard about these things, and that is exactly right. I've taken them from business as well.
Right, and so one thing that I think you need to ask here, because I've taken a lot of these flights as well, is where are they getting their funding? Because most of these organizations are not purely donation; they actually are getting grants to support flying people over these areas, and getting support from various organizations. And is that something you need to be questioning? Who, what grantors are supporting you while you provide these flights?
Yeah, and that brings up the question of how far back you should follow all of your checks. If you're writing for an NGO, where does the NGO get funded, and what's your sort of obligation to follow the money all the way back to somebody's pocket?
Hi, I'm Brian from the Scripps Fellowship. Just to add to this discussion a little bit, I did a lot of stories covering the military and the National Guard, and after Katrina happened, I was able to actually find a flight with just the National Guard, because they, if you get in touch with public affairs people, maybe you can avoid this particular dilemma. But that's another interesting question, because then it's sort of like the military is paying for the gas. So
right.
Just to add complicated layer.
Okay, we're running out of time, so we got one last question, which I think is sort of fun, so we'll just do this very last one, which is a question that came up earlier about repurposing your own work. Something that we should all be thinking about doing as much as we can for business reasons, but then when do we cross the line ethically? So here's a case of a guy who wrote a blog post about squid sex and really liked this metaphor he used for their spermatophores, which are these big weird packets of sperm. They kind of glob on each other. And then years later, he gets a commission to write about squid sex for a teen science magazine, and so he digs this blog post and this paper out of his files. So should he, A, cover the paper again, same paper, using different language appropriate to the audience and adding some reporting, maybe he'll call them up again, and then use the same metaphor for the spermatophore but change the wording? Should he, B, just tweak the blog a little bit and turn it in because it's his copyright and it didn't belong to anybody else in the first place? C, rule out covering the same paper or using the fun metaphor, go look for something new. Or D, cover the same paper but don't reuse any of the wording or the metaphor from his earlier work. I'll give you just a couple more seconds on that. All right. So it looks like most people think that as long as you add a little bit of reporting and don't use the same words, you're in the clear. And I've got to say that's probably the answer I would have chosen too. But interesting, and D is a kind of a similar response where you can cover the same paper, but you can't even use the same metaphor. So that's only the real only difference between A and D there. So reusing metaphors is something that I've actually wrestled with myself, because once you come up with a really good one and then you use it on something dumb like a blog post, and then you've got a really good, you know, commission with a really far-reaching audience and you really want to deploy that beautiful metaphor again, it can be very tempting. Okay, I think we're out of time. Who's going to have the last word here? Okay, Jennifer will give us our outro. Our positive fist pumping, freelancers are awesome, and we're all going to make a lot of money and be ethical feeling to ride into the reception with.
Yeah, first do the clickers first.
I'll come around.
Thanks, Emma, for bringing those. I think that was a fun way to do this. Thanks to the panel. This was really great. Really good stuff to think about. So give them applause, please. You ready? I'm tempted to take a survey of like who feels better about freelancing now than they did this morning, but everybody's tired, so I think everybody should, you know, go and loosen up and have some fun. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being so involved all day. I know this is a little static, sort of sitting like in a lecture hall, but with this many people, it's hard to arrange it any other way, and I hope that it's been really valuable for everybody. Please go and network all week while you're here. This is a great opportunity to learn about grants and marketing opportunities and a lot of the stuff we've talked about. There are many sources that are here in the form of people. Look for the Science Writers book at the bookstore, and there is a reception next door starting right now for the foreign journalists who came to the other workshop that's been going on today. You're welcome to come over, join it, meet them. There's people there from Asia, Africa, I'm not sure about Latin America. Really interesting group of people. There is a cash bar there, but the food is free. And the main SEJ welcome reception starts at 5. It's in the ballroom, which is somewhere in this hall. Thanks. One last thing. Yeah.
We're experimenting with something this year. We've got an app that we're trying to get everybody to use, so you can send messages back and forth to each other. You can see the agenda. You can add it to your calendar. It's just kind of something we're playing with to see, because people were saying, "Well, I don't feel like I'm interactive enough." And it's on Bizabo. You download bizabo.com, and then you just search SEJ 2013, just like the hashtag. And it keeps up with everything you tweet, and you can post, you know, pictures and interact with each other. And we're just kind of experimenting with it to see what happens. Like